The record?
We are.
Okay, we're back on the record for OTA-PA-09-005 in the appeal of Guam Community Improvement Foundation, Inc. It is 1:37 p.m. on September the 29th, 2009. We have completed the appellant's case in chief and presentation of evidence, and we are now at the point where the parties are going to give their closing arguments. As stated earlier, the order will be Mr. Abrams will go first on behalf of the purchasing agency, followed by Ms. Tang, who will go forward on behalf of IBC, the interested party, followed by Mr. Cunliffe, who will go on behalf of Guam Community Improvement Foundation, Inc. And Mr. Abrams, are you going to have a brief rebuttal?
If you don't mind, depending on how brilliant Mr. Cunliffe is, Mr. Willie, I may or I may not.
And Ms. Tang, are you going to have a brief rebuttal?
If I do, it would be very brief, I think.
Okay, very well. Okay. Mr. Abrams, whenever you're ready, you may proceed with your closing statement.
Well, I'm about as ready as I'll ever be. I'm just trying to get this. I still feel like I'm in a press conference with all these microphones. But first of all, I want to thank the public auditor, the hearing officer, and the staff here for making this happen so efficiently and so effectively. It's the first time, as you know, that I've appeared in this forum, and I found it remarkably efficient and even enjoyable for a professional exercise. So just wanted to say that before I forgot about it. Sometimes I get caught up in what I'm doing and I don't remember politeness. But I do appreciate all the efforts that have been made, and it was a very smooth proceeding. Now,
please talk into the mic.
Closing. I'm sorry, as far as a closing argument is concerned, I think about the best place to start with would be all this legislation that's enveloping this whole issue of substantial interest. You know, we really have a crisis situation. No matter who's at fault, no matter who divided, maybe there were some specifications that were wrong, maybe that came from the government, maybe Cortec didn't. You know, I could have called rebuttal witnesses to contradict Mr. Tenorio, but we just be getting into mudslinging and finger-pointing. I don't think it really behooves us to start worrying about whose fault it is that the existing facility is not measuring up, and just face the fact that it doesn't measure up. And I don't think the substantial interest confirmation really devolves into, oh, well, the government messed up here, they should have. So now they have to live with their mistakes. It's the children that are suffering. That's the name of the game here. It was the name of the game when the legislature passed the emergency legislation that wanted this school built, lickety-split. That was the first and foremost thing on the legislature's mind, is to get that school built yesterday if possible. And Public Works moved as quickly as it could. Maybe it didn't move as quickly as it should. And, you know, Gov Guam doesn't always do what it's supposed to do. But the spirit and the principle of alacrity pervades this whole process. I mean, there's not anyone in this room who would say that the children that are going to that teaching facility don't deserve the earliest possible construction of their school. Even Mr. Tenorio, who I suppose I would characterize as a hostile witness or an adverse witness because he's from the other side here, but even Mr. Tenorio was candid enough to say that he too subscribes to the spirit of the emergency legislation, and he agreed with me that the students need a new school at the earliest possible time. The inadequacies of the existing temporary facility were not lost on Mr. Tenorio. Okay, I know he has different interests than maybe the government, or certainly IBC, but now, From a practical standpoint, I think we have to also look at the fact, and I've talked to Mr. Cunliffe about this on an informal basis, and I'm not sure he agrees, but it seems inarguable that it is in this bidder's interest and the other bidder's interest for substantial interest to be confirmed and let the process proceed, forgetting for a moment that the children deserve this. But the bidders also deserve it. There's no guarantee, as I've mentioned in earlier comments here, that IBC is going to get the award. Who knows if IBC is going to be able to get the financing, especially since it was interrupted by the first protest, no, the second protest. Maybe they will, but nobody could say that their chances of getting financing put in place are the same as it used to be. So their position has been compromised. Maybe they'll be able to put together a finance package, and maybe they won't. If they don't, it goes to the next bidder. And then after that bidder, it goes to this bidder. So I'm not saying that the best shot Mr. Cunliffe's client has is by letting the procurement process go forward. I'm saying it is a shot. And if the procurement process does not go forward because substantial interest is not confirmed, he will never know if his client would have somehow by default or through some other mechanism ended up getting the award. But only by allowing it to go forward will Mr. Cunliffe's client or any other bidder get this award, and only by letting it go forward will the children of the territory get out of this wretched crisis that they're in and get into a decent educational facility. That is the nature of the emergency legislation that gave rise to the RFP and everything else that that is happening for the rebuild. The other piece of legislation is probably even more important, and that's Mr. Klitsky's Every Child Gets an Adequate Education Act. Now, in my opening argument, you may recall, I dwelt on this. And it again, I think it's appropriate for me to reiterate that this act says the top priority of the government. Not a top priority, one of, you know, we got a lot of priorities here, the hospital and everything else, the environment, but the top priority, higher than anything else, the act equates it to a constitutional right, is the education of our children. Is it to establish minimum standards, flushable toilets, are mentioned specifically in the Each Child Gets an Adequate Education Act. We've heard testimony that the toilets don't flush. We've heard testimony that to get a drink of water on the second floor is a major problem for these students. They have to, one witness, I think it's Ms. Starwell, and he's uncontradicted, unrebutted, said the kid would have to lower his face and suck the water out of whatever pipe it comes out of to get a drink of water. Can you imagine the sanitary issues with that? So, yeah, how far do you have to look to see that the existing facility is a makeshift interim, in Mr. Tenorio's words, facility. It's a temporary facility. Temporary doesn't mean, oh, well, we'll fix this. We'll just spend another couple of million dollars and expand into a 12,000 square foot facility that now houses their headquarters. It doesn't mean that. It means getting in and getting out as quickly as possible. And only by confirming the substantial interest of Larry Perez, are we going to do that? I mean, think about this. If we don't confirm the substantial interest of the territory, what's going to happen? We have, that facility, which was only designed for 6 months to a year, that's the only reason why they funded it for no more than a year, because nobody thought it would be more than a year anyway. But all of a sudden, that's going to have to morph over into who knows how long. Maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years. How long does anyone think it will really take to hear all these appeals? Well, I'm not saying that this is the time we're going to argue those appeals, but are those appeals obviously meritorious? This is something for the OPA to consider. I'm not going to argue that point. But I'm just saying, if you balance it, I think everything about this has to be a balance. On the one hand, you balance the need of an appellant's, the appellant's need to stop this process Let the kids keep going to this wretched facility. Stop it. Because we want our appeal heard before any ground is broken on this thing. And how selfish can you be? How self-centered is that? Who are they thinking of? Are they thinking of the welfare and the adequate education of our children? When they say freeze everything, it doesn't matter. Just like Mrs. Hendricks testified to, it'll be okay if we do it later. But that's not the spirit of the act. That doesn't respect the conditions of the Every Child Get an Education Act. It doesn't say every child gets an education after you wait for an appeal to run by. The emergency legislation that set up the rebuild of JFK doesn't say it's an emergency rebuild project, but if Mr. Cunliffe's client wants to stop that, we'll stop the clock on this emergency purpose and let Mr. Cunliffe's client appeal to the OPA, and if it loses, appeal to the Superior Court of Guam, and if it loses again, appeal to the Supreme Court of Guam. The emergency legislation is emergency, no ifs, ands, or buts. And when you read the preamble to the Every Child Gets an Education Act, and you see that the legislature of this island has spoken on making it the highest priority of this government, it's hard to understand how they would have, if they were sitting in this room with us, would tell you, well, it is the top priority of the government, but if there's an appeal in some procurement procedure, it's okay to let these kids go to a school which patently doesn't comport with the minimum requirements. I mean, read it. It says flushable toilets. We have uncontradicted testimony that there are unflushable toilets and there's a problem with drinking water at this school. Forget about there's no library. I mean, if you can forget about it. But this act, the Every Child Gets a Public Education Act, talks about toilets and drinking water. It also talks about a library that conforms with the legal standard mentioned in the act. Now, it's not a question of whether this library conforms or not. It isn't any library. Who ever heard of an accredited high school with no library, no chemistry lab? It's ridiculous. I think that we have well documented through all these witnesses, Mr. Shargaloff, Ms. Applegre, and Gail Hendricks. I really don't think it's especially productive to recapitulate all of their testimony. Everyone took notes. We have a record. We know what they said. And the bottom line is, something's got to go. They would even prefer to go back to double sessions at GW than to spend one more day in this miserable excuse for a high school. So the last thing I want to talk about, and I think I did say I was going to be brief, and that last thing, don't tell me I lost the last thing. The last thing is the Pacific Data Systems case that we cited. In our reply to appellant's memo, a declaration of substantial interest on September 21 this year, Mr. Cunliffe, in his legal argument earlier in this hearing, made the bold assertion that there's no authority or very little authority on substantial interest. Let me tell you something. This specific data case that we cited on page 3, it's misnumbered, actually. It is page 2, but the numbering is not correct, and I apologize for that. It's a typo. But at the bottom of our second page, Pacific Data Systems, Inc. versus Superior Court of Guam, that's a Guam case. Mr. Cunliffe has come forward with some federal cases, which, although the language is helpful to us, are not Guam cases. This is a Guam case. Guess what they were talking about in that case? They were talking about a substantial interest to proceed with the procurement of a few computers. And the court in that case confirmed the substantial interest of the territory in not waiting around for the appeals until they purchased some badly needed computers. We're not talking about badly needed computers here. I wish that were the case. We're talking about something of a magnitude that's incomprehensibly greater
than purchasing computers here. We're talking about purchasing a whole high school. Now, if the court in that case saw fit to confirm the department's determination of substantial interest, then, you know, I just can't conceive of how there would be a problem. After all the testimony we've heard, after the revelations that we've heard, I can't conceive of how there could be a moment's hesitation in stamping confirmation on Director Perez's determination of substantial interest. And in this case, it's very similar to the case here, and the authority of this case speaks to the legal principle. And Mr. Camacho will easily see this when he reads that case, is that unless there is something invalid on its face about the determination made by the director of the agency, then the OPA should confirm that and not go behind it. Now, I know that in the procurement regs we talk about the authority of the public auditor to look to consider these things de novo, but this is case law. And this case law says unless there's something obviously wrong with the determination by the department, the reviewing agency should not refuse to confirm that. And I suggest to you, Mr. Camacho, and Ms. and Madame Public Auditor, that there is nothing but documentation and there is nothing but accuracy in the determination of substantial interest by the Director of Public Works. And I'm saying to you that this case that I've cited here lays down the principle that unless there is something on the face of that determination by Director Perez, it should stand. And that is the capstone of the authority that I want to bring to your attention in this closing argument. And again, we cannot allow our children to graduate from a high school that may not be accredited. We can't allow that to happen. It may happen despite our best efforts, but we have to give it our best efforts. And unless we allow the bid procurement procedure to go ahead, in which Mr. Conrad's client does stand a chance, I'm afraid the children are going to suffer, and we have to put their interests first. Morally, we have to do it. Emotionally, we want to do it. And legally, we're obligated to do it. Thank you very much. I have nothing for you.
Thank you, Mr. Abrams. Ms. Day?
Thank you. The protest is a protest of the selection of IBC as the first rank offeror, not the award. Interestingly, the protest was filed on the eve of financing. Had the financing been approved, or had they gone out to market, the ducks would have been in line, to get the building constructed, sign the contract, and get the building started. It is interesting that most people would normally file a protest after award. But that is not the case here. I think we have to look at the parties and their interests and their various interests to really understand, I think, what the agendas and the motivations are. IBC is interested in building a school on the JFK project. It is able to get the financing for this project. There is no evidence that financing was not imminent. Mr. Tony Bloss testified that GITA did what it's supposed to do, what it did with respect to the Lola Cola bonding and also the landfill bond. It did nothing more, nothing extra, nothing special, no favoritism. This is necessary to get the municipal, the tax-free bond. This would have been a benefit to Guam. Now, that didn't happen because the protest was filed. A protest challenging the ranking. A protest based on suppositions and media reports. Why didn't they wait until the award was given? Why didn't they wait until that time to submit it in to protest? Because, obviously, I think the obvious conclusion is somebody was in the know. They knew financing was imminent. And I think that there are a lot of interests at stake, other than just the offeror's interest. We look at there was some testimony this morning about the Cortec lease. And I just tallied up the numbers. The original term of the lease would be almost $50 million, 10 years, if it were to go for the initial term. Including the option term, another 5 years, that's $74 million. What happens at the end of 74, at the end of 15 years? The building belongs to the landlord, not the government. So the government would have paid $74 million in 15 years for a building that doesn't own, for a building that the DOE people, representatives have testified is inadequate, terribly inadequate for the needs of the students. And an old building that has been refurbished, another 15 years, is going to be much older, in a worse condition. Nothing in the contract, the lease, says anything about capital reserves, capital improvements. Everything is extra, 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 change orders. That means it's going to cost more for the government. The collateral equipment, there's a lot of discussion about that. And the collateral equipment is part of the contract. My understanding under the public law is it was paid for up front, and it's going to be, it belongs to the government at the end. But it is inadequate because the facilities aren't sufficient to house the amount of collateral equipment that they need, the lockers. We talk about the appropriate desks, just things that a lot of people take for granted in schools. You want ease, you want a roof over the hallways, you got to pay for that. For $74 million, you don't even, can't even keep your kids out of the rain unless you pay $28,000. What does $28,000 get you? Cover for 100 students? Not 2,300, not even 1,000. You're going to squeeze 1,000 kids into that little hallway? I mean, let's think about what is really needed here. It's a school and the cost of it. The cost is an issue. And ultimately, what needs to be done is a new school needs to be built in a location that is adequate and that is accessible to students. I heard during the break, I forget who asked, but perhaps it was Madame Auditor about where the students live, where most of the students who attend JFK live, with Mecheche, that area. I don't recall who asked, but I heard that conversation. Well, if you have to, I'm sorry.
I'm here. I was asking.
Right, right. That's correct. No, it wasn't ex parte. It wasn't. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I just happened to be sitting here, and it occurred to me, gosh, if I were a parent, and I had to drive that child to school, going to Teason, fighting all those narrow driveways, and, it just goes around in circles, and they have airports with their radars, at 25 miles, the airport police, manning the airport. You've got just huge, problems with accessibility for those who live in Deverdo and then have to go to work. This is Tumon. Get off Marine Drive, turn around, get back on the road. The RFP for the JFK school not only provides for school, but the government will own in 30 years. But it is a school that will be maintained through that period. It is a school that within the RFP, my understanding is that there are capital reserves. There are maintenance janitorial contracts is involved in that too, included. That's something that we know isn't included in the current interim facility. And there's ownership. The government owns it at the end of the term. And with all these extras that are built into it, it's going to be, you know, I think a far better school in so many ways, in many ways. And the collateral equipment that will be procured on top of the, what's there will be procured for the building that's designed properly. I understand you can't buy something if you can't. It doesn't make sense to buy something if you can't put the chemistry equipment in the chemistry class. If you're limited by, you know, a little square box, you're going to put kids in there, equipment in there. You're going to put. If you have to choose, you put kids in there. But at what price? And what do you do with the equipment? And so I think those are things that need to be considered in terms of what is substantial interest of the territory. And Mr. Abrams alluded to the Pacific Data case, but I'd like to direct you to the PEDCO case. These two cases were attached to the filing we made yesterday. And just reading a very quick excerpt from that. And that was, this PEDCO case came out of the district court, sitting as an appeal from the Superior Court. And they also cited Pacific Data Systems held. That quote, the standard for the Superior Court's review of the executive branch's procurement action is to be whether a rational basis exists for the determination, i.e., it is not, that is, it's not an arbitrary decision. Further, that the district court insists that the Superior Court not substitute its judgment for that procuring agency. In PDS, the Pacific Data System case, the court held that, quote, it is appropriate to interfere and substitute a court's judgment for the administrator's only when there appears no rational basis for the procurement decision. We have long recognized that considerable weight should be accorded to an executive department's construction of a statutory scheme it is entrusted to administer. Rational basis. That's the standard for finding a confirmation of substantial interest. And did all those reasons that the string of witnesses gave, were those rational? Was it not capricious? Was it arbitrary? Those are very, very good reasons, very compelling reasons. GCIF cited to two other cases, two federal claims cases, which we have also attached for your convenience in our filing yesterday. That was the Riley Wholesale case and the Superior Helicopter case. And I will, I think it's very simple to simply say that it is inapplicable because those two cases arises under the automatic stay provisions in the Federal Competition and Contracting Act. Has nothing to do, which doesn't apply to this case at all. And in that particular provision that is referred to in those two cases, they say that if there's a protest, there's an federal automatic stay provision. It imposes a sanction, a suspension, or a stay of the procurement after award. And I need to underscore that. It has to do with a state provision that, one, has to do with, it's a federal statute, and two, it only addresses events after award. So I think for those reasons, it's simply inapplicable and irrelevant. We rely on 5GCA 5425G1. And I think the Guam cases clearly say that all you have to do is follow a rational basis. That's the standard. There isn't this four-part standard that's cited in those federal cases. They simply don't apply. And certainly has never been applied by Guam courts. Lastly, I'd like to focus on the WASC issues, the WASC accreditation. Having just gone through a WASC accreditation with a new school, I'm keenly aware of all the little details, and it's important. People won't enroll if you're not WASC accredited. And, you know, these kids, who go to JFK, and I'm going to assume, you know, are kids that, there are a lot of bright kids. I'm sure if they lost accreditation, a number of them simply don't have the option to say, well, let me go to a private school because it lost its accreditation. They don't have an option. WASC does, there's a reason for WASC accreditation. We want to make sure that school is able to uphold a minimum standard so the child gets the proper curriculum and is prepared and can go to college. Now, that doesn't just involve what classes or how many minutes you take. It's very important, the environment that the child, in which a child is nurtured and educated. That is a very important part of not just education, but every aspect of a child's life. And I think that the testimony was very clear. WASC, Mrs. Hendricks testified in having extensive experience in WASC accreditation. And this is, even if she didn't, it's in the handbook. It's online, and this specifically deals with the Pacific Islands Public Schools. It says, that report, Exhibit J, was a warning. It wasn't a, you know, don't forget this, don't forget to you know, make sure your kids, you know, check up on this curriculum or that curriculum. Build your school. It was a priority recommendation that's equivalent of a warning. Next step is there are only two options. You might get 1 year accreditation or you lose your accreditation. That's the penalty for not following the warning. And a number of the principal, Mr. Chogoloff, Ms. Hendricks, Ms. Affleck, we all testified. And my sense is, you know, they did it because they believed it, that it was in the children's best interest to go back to GW if they had, as opposed to if they had a choice. And Mrs. Hendricks testified, well, if that happens and accreditation were to be notified, it would not only impact JFK's accreditation, but GW's. So we've got two schools who's going to be in jeopardy. Is this substantial interest or is it not? I think this is a clear, clear case for substantial interest. Just on the WASC issue alone, anyone who has kids, you know that accreditation is so important, especially kids who may not have choices to switch schools or go to a private school. How many parents can afford in this economy to write $500 a month for private schooling? Very few, I think. So on WASC accreditation alone, I think the OPA can find substantial interest. And that, on top of all the other things that have been discussed, or the testimony that's been given. IBC is ready, willing, and able to build, but we need a clear, strong message from the OPA's office, from the Office of the Public Auditor, and your decision, and your findings. The courts give great deference to the decisions of the OPA. I certainly do, but I think the courts do as well. And I think that opinion needs to be clear and very strong in support of the kids. And you know, I think the school needs to be built. There's no question about it. And that needs to be done expeditiously. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tang. Mr. Cummings?
Thank you. First, I would just like to say that the majority of what was argued by Ms. Tang has nothing to do with substantial interest was not a matter that should be taken into consideration when this decision is finally made. And substantial interest is not a moving target. Substantial interest is set forth in the government's declaration of substantial interest. And it's not WASC, and it's not accreditation, and it's not a lot of things that they've brought out today because they didn't make that part of their substantial interest. And this body does not have to, cannot make a ruling on some substantial interest issue which was not addressed in their declaration of substantial interest. So they are bound by their declaration of substantial interest. And the situation, first I would like to get to the two cases they have cited, the Pacific Data and the Pedro cases. And the statement that I made earlier, as I recall, was that those cases do not define substantial interest. And 5 GCA 5425 G1, which is the ability to determine a substantial interest, doesn't say it is a substantial interest of the government or the territory. It is the substantial interest of the territory. So we must look beyond the limited and into the general scope. And that's why we provided the two cases, the Riley case and the helicopters case, because the federal law, which is talking about a similar statute using similar language, has set forth how you determine substantial interest. And what have they decided substantial interest is? And as I said, no one in Guam has yet to define that. But between Superior, Helicopter, and Riley, they say whether significant adverse consequences would occur, not may occur, not might occur, but would occur if the agency did not override the stay. Whether reasonable alternatives to the override of the stay were available. How the benefit of overriding the stay compared to the potential cost of the override, including costs associated with the potential that the protester might prevail. And finally, the impact of the override on the competition and the integrity of the procurement system. Now, in their citing to Pacific Data and PEDCO, they have cited you language where the court addressed the court's requirements and their position in granting deference to a co-equal branch of government. They talk about the court giving deference to the agency of the executive. Our law also creates matters which are important other than the every child gets an adequate education law. We have a law that creates the Office of the Public Auditor's oversight over the government procurement to ensure the integrity of the procurement system. And in that integrity review, the Office of the Public Auditor is in the executive branch, and she has the right to do a de novo review. They don't have to, nor has this body, the public auditor, previously given the deference argument full relief. And that was a case involving Guam Memorial Health Authority, OPA decision 07-005, where the government made the same argument and the OPA ignored it. So you have jurisprudence within the OPA's decision that their argument is not binding. Some of the things that have been said, I wish to address. The argument that the students and the faculty don't deserve anything but the immediate reconstruction of the school. I don't think anyone has come before this body and said that they don't need to reconstruct JFK. The question is the procurement process being followed, which is an obligation of the public auditor to determine and make a distinction and a determination that the government is following appropriate procurement regulations, doing it properly, and making sure that we're getting the bang for the buck. I think it's not a surprise to anyone that these schools, not only JFK, are in terrible condition. We've seen the Attorney General close them because of violations of the law, which I asked Mr. Perry about. He enforces the building codes and the safety codes. Why hasn't he gone out and done something with JFK before? And he said, well, we didn't have the money. That's not an answer. They're now saying, look, we want you, Madam Public Auditor, to say that the substantial interest of the territory requires us to just go ahead and award this contract. There's been no evidence presented by the government as to how long it would take to reissue this bidding process or the RFP. They say that it's selfish of my client to want to do this properly. They say we could drag this on through the courts. I say they could reissue the RFP. It was told to be done in 30 days, with a response in 30 days, initially. And let me go to that timeline. In the documents that have been submitted, there's an indication that the governor ordered the closure of JFK on June 9th, 2008. He declared a state of emergency regarding JFK on August 8th of 2008. So some 2 months passed from closing it, that nothing was done, until he declared a state of emergency. 2 months later, on October 10th of 2008, the legislature passed Public Law 29-114. It directed Public Works to issue an RFP in 30 days. 38 days later, Public Works issued an RFP. So it was not timely done. It required all proposals to be submitted by December 16th, 2008. They didn't get that, and they extended that time frame. They then issued a letter which has the typed date of January 16, 2009, telling Guam Foundation, the Educational Foundation, that they were not the winning bidder, but we may want to talk to you in the future. And that was dated January 16, 2009. It was signed by the director on March 4th, 2009, and sent out. So over a month and a half, it sat in Public Works. On March 4th, in that letter, presumably they began negotiations with IBC. Guam Community Improvement Foundation filed a protest on August 5th, 5 months later. And according to what we're told, no award has been made. So we have 14 months from the closing of JFK until the protest was filed, and no award had been made. 5 months elapsed for IBC to try to locate financing. In her argument, Ms. Tang argues that IBC is ready to go forward, and there's nothing to indicate that they couldn't proceed immediately if the OPA issues their substantial interest letter. But the testimony from the GEDCA people, GEDCA people, in the letter, Exhibit J, said that their bond counsel said that financing would not be available in those markets as long as there was an appeal possible. So, and that's in the second page of the Exhibit G, it is, under investors' perception. Interestingly, apparently the other bidder is also appealing to the public auditor their case, so that what in reality, I guess nothing can happen until that case reaches these kind of proceedings, because the stay is in place because of that as well. Now, there are also, and we submitted one as our Exhibit A, a bill introduced by in the legislature in March, I believe, or no, more recently, to do away with the current law, which is the authorizing mechanism upon which this bid is based, and do a financing internally in the government and just do a design-build contract. If that passes, this whole thing is going to be down the drain in any event. So the situation is such that there are so many issues out there with regard to this matter, and it is not the selfishness of my client, and I don't think it's selfish of anyone, to want to ensure that government procurement is done properly and legally. Now, Mr. Abrams indicated that there's no guarantee that IBC will get the award. So how long are the negotiations going to last? He also indicated that they've got to be out of there in a year because it's only been funded for 1 year. Well, appropriations in the government only go year to year. You can't appropriate multiple years. It's always subject to appropriation. So, he indicated that this is the highest priority of the government. And their argument as to the substantial interest is that no other interest of the government can supplant the desire to build a new JFK. That we don't have to have open and fair and honest government procurement. The situation that I find extremely frightening is that we all know that there are problems that go on in procurement. There are people who get arrested for doing improper things as government employees and getting jobs and getting positions and getting contracts. If the Office of the Public Auditor doesn't define what the substantial interest test is, we could have an agency put out a bid for a new hospital. And they could go to Randy Cunliffe and say, you put in a bid, we'll declare you the winner. And if they protest, we'll just declare a substantial interest and we'll award you the contract. It's rife with the possibility of fraud. And that's why the federal government has clearly defined what is necessary to go into making a determination of a substantial interest. Now, there's been a lot of argument about the Guam law for every child gets an education. But that law is not before this hearing. It's been discussed, but it's never been admitted into evidence. It wasn't submitted as an exhibit. And It's not before you for the decision-making process. What they talked about in their determination of substantial interest was a healthy, safe, and sanitary learning environment, citing to that law, but not attaching the law. They didn't talk about chemistry labs or libraries or other situations that are before this body by way of testimony. There was a statement made that the highest priority of the government. Yet we heard testimony that the school has asked for a covered walkway to get to the cafeteria. It's been submitted for a change order because it wasn't included in the contract, and the governor's office hasn't acted on it. Is it the highest priority of this government? Other change orders have been put in place and haven't been acted on by the governor's office. Is it the highest priority? And Natalie, public auditor, you were a senator. You understand what goes through senators' minds, how they act, what they do. Clearly money has been a problem in the government of Guam for a number of years. We haven't had the large amount coming in that came in the 90s as income to the government. And we have the difficulties in paying. But the substantial interest of the government is not to simply override the procurement process so that we might be able to start a contract in 3 months, 5 months, 7 months, 9 months. We don't know that. The school, which is now being used, was built to the specifications of the government. The equipment, which was purchased, was based on the request of the government. We now hear that they aren't satisfactory. They aren't sufficient to provide these students with everything they need. As I stated in an argument as to an objection, the government can't create a crisis and then claim that it's a substantial interest not to follow the procurement statutes in order to undo the crisis that they created. And the federal cases talk about the good faith of the procurement process. Has the government acted in good faith? Have they looked at reasonable alternatives to overriding the stay? We hear the government argue about the water pressure problems. And Mr. Tenorio testified the GWA is trying to correct the deficient water problems that exist in the Tijan area as we speak. So the situation is such that there are alternatives. They could put the bid out again. Government could pass a law saying we're going to fund it ourselves and submit it to the governor for his signature, which requires 10 days. They haven't shown that any of the exigencies that they believe may occur will occur. And the deficiencies are because of the government, not because of the contract or the bidders, or the proposers in this case. In The case of Advanced Systems Development versus U.S. 72 Federal Claims 25, the court therein says, you know, in order for the override decision to be proper under the best interest provision, there must be some rationale above and beyond the principle which was originally sought when the agency decided to engage the bidders in the competitive procurement. And they haven't put forth anything that wasn't existing at the time they put out the procurement. JFK didn't exist. There wasn't a school when they put out this procurement. They didn't have a place for the students to go in 2009 when they put out the procurement. They have come up with an alternative that puts the children in a location while they proceed with this contract. And as has been testified to, the contract provides the contractor with 9 months to complete the construction after the award. So there's no time frame before the award, other than put the RFP out, have the RFP come in. The diligence has not been there by the bidders or the offerors, IBC, or the government. 5 months had elapsed from the time that they were told that they were going to be the ones that they were supposed to have this contract before we filed an appeal. And they hadn't even gotten funding, which was an interest of 70% of the bid award was the funding, the finance. So where are we with regard to these matters? There are alternatives which the government may not wish to pursue. We have no ability to force the government to do those things. But they can't create the crisis. It's like the little boy who cried wolf. He creates the crisis, and then he wants somebody to pull him out of it by saying, I have the substantial interest of the territory, not a substantial interest of the territory. The children at JFK obviously need a new school. The old school has been condemned. There's an indication that the use of this facility at Fijian may be for other schools that also need to be torn down in the future because the government has not maintained these facilities, and Ms. Hendricks testified that it was like pulling teeth to get into patronage, to get them to change the louvers at JFK, to seal the louvers so the air conditioning stayed inside. So there's no doubt that Tang's client, the Attorney General, my client, the other protesters would like to see JFK be done, but not at the damage and violation of the procurement. If we start allowing agencies who are doing contracting to declare substantial interest, and this only came before the OPA under the statute because our appeal had already been filed here. Had they made a substantial interest declaration prior to our appeal, it wouldn't come to the OPA. We would have to go directly to court. So if they start playing that game, as soon as an award is made and a protest is filed, they can file a substantial interest declaration. It doesn't come to the OPA, and off they go awarding the contract. So it's not selfishness that brings us here. It's to ensure that we have a procurement system that isn't taken advantage of, that is properly, adequately handled by those in charge of it and have the opportunity for the OPA's office to review these matters and make those determinations. That's what makes sure that the corruption doesn't continue to creep into government procurement. And we would ask that the substantial interest of the territory be denied in this case because of the matters which they have requested, they have not proven, and therefore we would ask that this go before a hearing as expeditiously as possible to determine the violations, if any, of the procurement. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cole.
Okay, Mr. Cunliffe, during your closing, you made reference to a bill that's currently before the legislature.
I submitted it as Exhibit A in our exhibit list.
And is that in your opposition to...
That's on my exhibit list.
Oh, your regular exhibit list.
Yes.
Very well. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Abrams?
Could we have a two-minute recess before I make some rebuttal comments? Would that be all right?
Let's take a brief recess. That's fine.
And can we go off the record?
Can we go off the record?
Back on record?
Okay, we're back on the record in OPA-PA-09-005. In the appeal of Guam Community Improvement Foundation, Inc. Mr. Cunliffe has completed the appellant's closing argument, and pursuant to his earlier request, Mr. Abrams will then proceed with a brief rebuttal in this matter. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be brief. I'm not sure if I'm responding to all of Mr. Cunliffe's various imaginings in order, but I'd like to address the first one that I remember that he said. He mentioned in his closing that we haven't shown what may occur will occur. And I picked up on that. But yet, his argument is full of what-ifs. What if there's a new RFP? What if there's a new bill? What if bond counsel is right? What if, what if, what if? It's Mr. Cunliffe, not us, that hasn't shown what may occur will occur. We have shown beyond any question what will occur in terms of the suffering of the students at the current facility. Mr. Cunliffe is full of conjecture. Talks about a bill that we don't know if it'll ever be passed. We don't know what form it'll be in. He talks about a new RFP, which is beyond anybody's contemplation right now. He talks about, earlier in the case, about a groundbreaking that never took place. He talks about what if the bond counsel is right. And then Mr. Cunliffe, three times I recorded him saying things like this: to do this properly and legally, we cannot confirm substantial interest. We cannot override the procurement process. If we confirm substantial interest, we are not following the procurement process. But inherent in the procurement process is a provision in the procurement regs for a substantial interest determination by the purchasing agency and the confirmation of that determination if it has a rational basis. So we are following the procurement regulations when we confirm substantial interest because that is provided for there. And it's not like we're not going to hear the appeal. The appeal will be heard. We'll double track this. And I'm all for an expedited appeal hearing. And Mr. Cunliffe He says he's extremely frightened by what? Did he say, did I hear him say that he was extremely frightened about the plight of the students getting a second class or a third class education at what was supposed to be a temporary facility morphing over into something beyond temporary and permanent? Is he frightened about that? No. You know what he's frightened about? He said he's extremely frightening that some part of the procurement regs are imperfect or haven't been imperfectly followed. That's what frightens him. You know what frightens us? You know what frightens Larry Perez? You know what frightened the legislature when they passed an emergency bill? They weren't frightened about what Mr. Connell's frightened about. They're frightened about the children's education. That's what they were frightened about. And I suggest that Mr. Connell's fright is misplaced. Now, mention was made by Mr. Connell, I'm almost finished now, about, hey, they won't even approve $25,000 for a roof over the walkway. He's expecting the legislature to do all kinds of things. He's expecting the legislature to go ahead with that bill and build the new JFK facility and spend the money, what is it, $30 million, $50 million, whatever it might cost. He expects the legislature to do that. He expects the legislature to pay Cortec between $3,500 and $4 million a year in total for that lease year after year until the appeals are all heard here in the Superior Court and the Supreme Court. He expects the legislature to cover that for the taxpayers. And on top of everything else, he expects the legislature, the government of Guam, to open its checkbook and do things that were never intended to be expenses with a temporary facility. Every time Gov Guam pays another nickel, puts another nickel into that miserable facility out there at Tejon, it's making it more permanent. And that's not what the legislature talked about. They didn't say, okay, well, we're going to do two things here. We're going to build on an emergency procurement basis a new high school, and at the same time, we're going to put up an equivalent structure or something roughly equivalent out at Tejon. It was never meant, it was never contemplated the teaching facility to be a permanent facility and to have all these things done. It's not a matter of fixing something that can never be fixed, something that will always be broken. It's a matter of getting out of there at the soonest possible moment and getting into the new high school. That's why the government is dragging their heels on all these change orders. The focus of the government is not on perfecting an imperfect temporary facility. The focus of the government is on getting into the new facility that the law envisaged and bringing the standards of education up to the Every Child Gets a Decent Education Act. So, Mr. Cunliffe, over and over again, says we should do this properly and legally. I heard him say that. Override the procurement process. We shouldn't do that. Not following the procurement process. But guess what? Have a look for yourself. In the protest and the appeal by Mr. Cunliffe's client, not one violation of the procurement regulations was cited. Not one. He surmises in his protest. You know, surmise is defined as conjecture. We have a protest and appeal based on the denial of that protest. The protest is based on what I read on page 8 of the PDN. I don't know if it's right or not. I surmise. I speculate. I submit to you, Madam Public Auditor and Hearing Officer, that that is not enough of a basis to tie up a multi-million dollar project like this that will address the inadequacies of that educational facility out there now. It's a flimsy basis to put a halt on that. If he wants to bring that out in his appeal, whatever he's talked about in his protest, okay, the procurement regulations allow that. But in this case, we have a company by Mr. Tenorio's own admission, which is less than a year old, never done a construction job before, and wants to protest prior to the award without even citing any violation of the procurement regulations by the Department of Public Works. So crank all that into the equation when you decide if there is a proper confirmation of the substantial interest. And while I'm on that subject, I think the situation at this point will allow the discretion of this office, of the Office of Public Accountability, to consider whether this appellant should be required to post a bond. If you are not going to confirm the substantial interest, if you are, for whatever reasons I cannot imagine, but if you, in your wisdom, if you feel that the substantial interest determination should not be confirmed, I can't imagine that you would do that, but if it's possible, at least make them put up a bond, because this is a pre-award protest and appeal. It's an award and a protest appeal that cites no ascertainable violation of the procurement regulations. It's a protest and an appeal based on a surmise. Look, everybody knows, well, at least every lawyer knows, and many people who aren't lawyers, many highly educated people know that if you're going to go into court and you're going to ask for an injunction against a bridge being built because it violates environmental standards, you have to put up a bond. Because if your suit fails, the cost to the government and the cost to the public has to be recovered. If you're in the neighborhood of an airport and you go in front of a judge and you want to tie up the construction of that airport, and you do so because it hurts your ears or some other flimsy reason, I'm telling you, you're going to have to put up a bond if you're going to be allowed to proceed. And I'm suggesting that in the unlikely event, forgive me for saying unlikely because I believe we have every reason to expect confirmation with all due respect, but if I'm wrong about that, then I think a bond would lie, a required bond of the appellant to secure the government if it has to wait and wait and costs go up, and financing costs goes up, and material costs go up, and it has to be put out for rebid. If they lose that appeal, they made a mistake. If they make a mistake, they have to pay for it. I pay for my mistakes. You pay for your mistakes. What about me? That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just referring to the cases cited, I will...
He's talking to the mic.
Referring to the cases cited, Petco and Pacific Data System specifically address 5GC5425G, the section that discusses when the government the agency can proceed if it's necessary to protect a substantial interest of the territory. So those two cases are particularly on point. The cases cited by the federal cases, the word substantial interest doesn't even appear in any of those cases. I will note, interestingly, following up on Ms. Gabriel's comment about binding, the case was cited by the Riley case I was looking at. Specifically, in that case, the court binding. The cases they cited. It's 73 Fed CL 705. This is the Riley's wholesale case. Court ordered bonding in that case. That they put up a bond in connection with a protest. Last point, reissuance of the RFP does not make sense. What does it do? It delays matters. Why is it, I think it doesn't benefit the territory of Guam. It certainly benefits Quetek. It's more for DPW. You have to start from ground zero again. And again, if they don't get ranked number one, are they going to protest? Probably. Are we going to be back in here? Are we doing the same thing we did the last 2 days? Possibly. Delay, delay, delay appears to be the name of the game. And it's not in the interest of the territory. Last thing, what I've heard in the last 2 days are complaints about the building. But has Quetek, Mr. Tenorio, or representatives here taking responsibility for even little problems? It's just always somebody else's fault. It's GW's fault because there's not enough PSI in the water so that the kid doesn't have to put his lips on the sink, the water dispenser to get water. Well, it's not the government's fault because, yeah, they the wire that was sticking out was just the pool wire. It's everybody else's fault but theirs. Nobody there is taking any responsibility. Nobody's coming to the table and saying, yeah, we also want the school built. We also think that this is important, and this is how we can do it. But every time the issue comes up, it's always somebody else's fault, the government. DPW can't get their work, their stuff together. They're slow. They're not following the public law. They're not doing their job. Nobody's doing their job. DOE doesn't know what they're buying. That's what I hear. That's the response. And when you think about it, that's, in a sense, it's all irrelevant. But it is and it isn't. At the end of the day, this, you need to make a decision. Is there a substantial interest to get the school built? And I think that all the evidence that you've heard warrant a confirmation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tang. We're going to take the motion for substantial confirmation of substantial interest by the purchasing agency under advisement. We will issue a written decision shortly. Thank you all, and that will conclude this hearing at 2:55 p.m. on September the 29th, 2009. Thank you all. Bye.
If I may ask, what's tomorrow's here? Oh. To be sure.
Yeah. Well, I did issue my notice on
Mr. Camacho, you want this offer on?
Turn it on, please. Okay. One issue came up concerning the notice of the pre-hearing conference pursuant to my September 16, 2009 notice. That is the pre-hearing conference for the hearing on the merits.
Okay.
For the appellant's appeal. And that will be had at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning here. That's just to schedule, as stated in the notice, the formal hearing and discuss other ancillary matters pertaining to the formal hearing. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you.